Okay, good afternoon. So today we'll continue talking about some topics related to performance. First, some logistical things. So we graded the exam. Median was around an 80 after rubric and all that. 25th percentile around a 73, 75th percentile around an 87. A little worse than the first exam, and I think I set the rubric in the right place because given like how many people got certain questions right, so sanity check. So that's how it is. If you have regrades, please submit them soon, because I'd rather deal with them like in the next couple weeks and not try to figure something out at the end of the semester. And also, I should talk about the upcoming homework in lab. So we have some labs that are new this semester, and so who knows how they'll go. So one of them is this week, it's a lab on loop optimizations. And next week there's a lab on vector instructions, which we'll talk about later today and or Thursday. So since these are new, I'd like to know if they go well. They might not. They might be way too easy, they might be way too hard. I'm gonna grade them more leniently than I would something where we know how much each student typically gets done. So hopefully those are useful. So you also have homework, which, you know, previously, the reason these are new labs this semester is that the labs for this week and next was just work on the homework, and that's not the case anymore. So they have the homework, which is separate. And unlike every single other homework in this course, you are allowed to work with a partner. You're allowed to work with up to one partner. You can work alone, or you can work with one other person. You cannot work with groups of three. Don't ask. And these assignments are performance optimization assignments. So your grade is based on taking some code we give you and modifying it so when we run it on our system, it runs faster. And how much faster determines your grade. And there are two parts, each of which has a separate submission. You submit the same file for each, but we'll take a look at what you submitted before each deadline when determining your grade. So the first part is to rotate an image. So you have an image in memory, and we want you to rotate it. And the second part is to smooth or blur an image. So you have an image in memory, we want you to take the average over each little section to get a blurred version of it. So our images are represented as arrays of pixels, and pixels are, and I will write this down because my slide is wrong. Pixels are going to be a struct and an unsigned char red, comma, green, comma, blue, comma, alpha. So the alpha is meant to represent transparency. It also makes the assignment work a lot better, even though it's not necessary. So this is what your pixels are represented as, and they're stored as a big array, just like we saw with the matrices. So we have the row of pixels together, and you need to multiply by the width of the image. And the code we'll give you to start out with looks like this for rotate. So you have the pixel type, which is that struct containing red, green, blue, alpha. And we have this funny thing, RIDX. So RIDX is something that's supplied to you in the given code. It's a macro. I'll talk about what that means. So it looks like a function. And if given a coordinate and a coordinate and the width of the image, it computes the index in the one-dimensional array that represents the pixels of the image for that. And you don't have to use RIDX in your solution. You're encouraged to take advantage of how the image is actually laid out in memory. For example, it would be useful if you want to know whether cache optimizations would work. You want to know what pixels are actually next to each other. So this is the rotate part, which is the first part of the assignment. That's what you do graphically. you have the code, we're going to test, do you do the same thing the given code does? Okay, so as I said, Redux is a preprocessor macro, so a macro. And so you may have seen macros like this. So double here is a macro. So it takes an X and does X times 2. So if you have coefficient Y equals double 100, you get 100 times 2. But unlike what you're used to with like functions, this is not a function. This is actually a text substitution. So it literally expands to that. The compiler, as part of processing the code, generates that second line and compiles that. This means that if you do something like this and have 3 plus 3 and you pass it to that, it literally expands to 3 plus 3 times 2. And this is probably why we have not encouraged you to use macros at most points in the past. But the given code we have uses macros. And this means that typically when you see people writing macros in real C code, they'll do something like this. They'll have this apparently needless parentheses around all the arguments to the macro, which the code we give you does, in order to make this text substitution not break the order of operations that you expect. So with that in mind, this is what Redux is. So it's, it takes an X, a Y, and an N. It takes X times Y, N plus Y. So if you just want to write, you know, I times dim minus I, if you just want to write dim minus 1 minus j times dim plus 1 in your code, you can do that. It's exactly the same. It's just provided for your convenience, and that's what the existing code is doing. So any questions about this way of indexing particular parts of this image, our 2D, turning our 2D indexes into 1? Okay. And as I said, so in the assignment, as you will read, you can submit multiple variants of multiple potential optimizations. And when you submit them, I will measure them on my machine. There will be a viewer, so you can view the results on my machine, because my machine is different from yours and will have different performance. Like, I have different size caches. I probably have a different version of the processor, microarchitecture than the lab machines, and probably your laptops. So results might not be portable. Generally, if something's faster on your machine by a lot, it's probably still faster on my machine, but this is not guaranteed. And another factor here is compilers can differ, but you can control for that by using the exact same compiler in the lab machines. And the goal here is that there's a certain speed up you need to achieve. And I've set those thresholds based on what certain versions of the code that do certain optimizations do. So I think it's definitely achievable and involves things you should know how to do. And so unlike prior semesters, for the second part of the assignment, we're actually going to tell you pretty explicitly, here are things that will work, because we're going to have you use vector instructions, which we're going to talk about. And in order to have you use vector instructions and still have the same as the old assignment stuff too, I just provided you a lot more guidance as to what to do, so it's probably about as difficult. For the first part of the assignment, we're not going to tell you what to do. We're just going to say, here's the code, make it faster, do whatever you need to do. So general advice, when we don't tell you what to do, is just, there's techniques we talked about in the book, in lecture, try them when it's acceptable. If they're parameters, you might need to vary them. Like, just because cache blocking with a certain, with, you know, 128 element wide blocks didn't work, doesn't mean another size might not perform better. So you should, you know, not give up on something because, you know, you might have just chosen the wrong number. And some techniques combine well. And in particular, you might not find, for example, like I found that cache blocking works until you do loop optimizations first or something like that. You might find that you need to combine optimizations for one of those to look like it does anything. Okay. So any questions about the homework? I guess another note on the homework is that the due date. So it's on the calendar. So the first part is due next week. The second part is due after Thanksgiving. If you don't want to work on Thanksgiving, you're welcome to finish it before where the deadline was originally set. I figured I don't care whether or not you hand it in before or after, I might as well give you the extra time and avoid complaints. Okay. So any comments, questions about the homework? Probably ask after you've actually looked at it again. Okay. So last time we were talking about loop unroll. So this was an optimization which reduces the number of instructions that you run. And the idea is that as you do more loop unrolling, you have less and less instructions devoted to maintaining our eyes and doing our comparisons. And so hopefully this will just keep running faster and faster, although we're eliminating fewer and fewer instructions each time we do more loop unrolling. So let's look at what happens when I, did some loop unrolling. So I had doing that sum operation, and I had an array of 992 elements, which fit in my L1 cache. So cache misses, not a problem here. Everything's a hit. And I did this multiple times, so I was sure everything was in cache. And you can see that when I unrolled a little bit, I got a lot of benefit from unrolling from one time to two, and then a little extra, and then nothing. And this is not because I wasn't executing significantly less instructions. I was actually still executing significantly less instructions, more so than the performance benefit I would gain would indicate. So this is kind of weird. And this is this limit here where I'm improving the instructions I execute, but have this performance wall I'm hitting where I can't get any better by doing more, doing stuff with less instructions is called, by our book, the latency bound. And this has to do with something about how real processors work, which is not how our pipeline processor works. So in our pipeline processor, this would never happen. So the only reason we would have less instructions executing, less instructions executing but not take significantly less time is if we had somehow had more pipeline stalls, and there's no reason for that to happen. These add operations should take a single cycle, and in fact they do. And so there's no stalling because we can always forward for them. So in our pipeline processor, we'd expect this not to happen. So real CPUs are doing something different. And we're going to talk a bit about how modern day processors work, which makes this sort of thing happen, where when you look at the number of instructions running, even if there's not a reason for any stalling, you can end up with not getting an improvement in performance. So there are two aspects of this which contribute to this problem. And I've mentioned them both briefly earlier when I talked about things we do beyond pipeline. So one of them is that modern processors try to execute multiple instructions at once, not just like our pipeline one does, but they actually try to start multiple instructions at once. So they execute and start multiple instructions at once. So they're issuing multiple instructions every time step, in addition to having some instructions in the decode step and some instructions in the execute step at the same time. They fetch multiple instructions at the same time, decode multiple instructions at the same time, and execute multiple instructions at the same time. And they also try to execute instructions out of order. So they're not looking at what instruction is next in the program to determine whether or not they're running an instruction. They're looking at what instruction is next that I have the values for. So that means that you can't just say, oh, you have to increment the loop index between this add and this add. That's not going to prevent the processor from doing the second add earlier. And we saw this sort of obvious benefit from out of order, which is that when we have something slow, like a memory read, that can hide it. But this also has an effect even when we don't have these obvious stalling operations. And that's making it hard for us to intuitively guess the performance based on how our pipeline processor works. So let me give you a rather confusing diagram of what, you know, sort of from a very high level, a modern processor might look like. So we fetch multiple instructions per cycle. So we have basically two fetches that happen in parallel. And then we do some decoding, and in this case, the decoding is probably not reading registers, but mostly actually figuring out what the instruction does. So we do that, some of that in parallel. And then we have this funny thing, hardware data structure, I'm calling an instruction queue. So we have this big list of instructions that we fetched and decoded. And from that list, we're somehow going to figure out the hardware. It's going to figure out what to send to the actual things that do the execute steps or the memory steps. So we have a bunch of ALUs. We have a load store thing that accesses memory, accesses the cache, presumably. And we're somehow going to take things from this instruction queue that we can start running now, and we're going to take them off and do the computation. So then we have this second queue here, which I've called a reorder buffer. And the purpose of this reorder buffer is to keep results of instructions we've done but aren't ready to commit the values for yet, where we don't know whether or not some prior instruction is going to stop our program, or we have a branch misprediction, or we just, you know, want to wait for the instructions before it to finish. So this reorder buffer is basically, we're going to collect all the results we have, and when we have the result for the first instruction, we're going to write that back. When we have the results for the next instruction, we're going to write that back, and so on. But while we're still not in sync with the program, where we're still doing things out of order, the reorder buffer is going to just keep our results until we have the first one. So that's a second data structure. So the reorder buffer decides when to write back things, and that means that this part of the processor here is in order, and this part is in order. So everything but the actual computation happens in order. So it looks basically like our pipeline processor. The execute stuff is the only stuff which happens out of order, where we take values when they're available. So we're fetching multiple instructions and then have this list of pending instructions that we work on. And so when our textbook described this, one big thing they talked about is execution units. And that's the idea, is that this instruction queue, this list of pending instructions, is feeding what are commonly called execution units, which are basically ALUs or other things that do the real work of the instruction. So the most notable other thing is the cache. So that's an execution unit because it takes loads and stores and does them. And we're just going to have a big collection of these in this processor. Unlike our, you know, pipeline processor, we're not just going to have one ALU. Because we want to run multiple instructions at once, we're going to have more than one. And we might have different kinds. For example, we might have some ALUs for things which we can do in one cycle and another for slower things, like multiplication or division. And that's fine, because we'll just, whenever we have an instruction, we'll only send it to the appropriate kind of functional unit. So we'll have some logic that looks at the instruction queue and says, are the operands available and where do I send this? And sends it to the right ALU or to the load store unit, depending on the kind of instruction it is. And these ALUs will vary in how they work. So some of them might be pipelined, some of them might not be. And when we get the results back, as I said, we collect them in the reorder buffer. And something I'm not quite mentioning here very explicitly is that forwarding happens, and I'm not showing it in this picture. So the big reason we don't explain how to build this kind of processor is because I don't want to explain how exactly forwarding and squashing work for this kind of processor. But the instruction queue and reorder buffer from a high level somehow handle forwarding, so we don't need to wait for the value to be written back to use it in a future instruction. So they figure out the forwarding and do lots and lots of bookkeeping to make that work. And they handle squashing. So we're still doing branch prediction, so you can run instructions that we might have to squash later. So any questions about this sort of high level flow? So I'll dive into sort of a more detailed example of what happens. So let's look at the instruction queue. So I said the instruction queues are a list of pending instructions. So let's say we're running something which does a lot of ads. And the instruction queue is going to contain the list of instructions. And it's also going to keep track of what instructions it can start running, and for the ones it can't, what instructions it's waiting to finish. It needs to know what instructions it's waiting to finish, so when that instruction finishes, it can mark it as ready again. And basically what the instruction queue is going to do is every cycle it's going to say what execution units I have. In this example, I have just two ALUs. And it's going to say, I'm going to take all the ready instructions and try to put as many of them as possible on each execution unit. So in this case, we have exactly one ready instruction. So we're going to send instruction number one to ALU one. And then we have another ALU, but we can't do anything with it. So we're just going to send a pipeline bubble to that. And in this example, my ALUs are just going to take one cycle. So I send something to them, and the next cycle I have the result, I can use it in other instructions. So after I send this, in the next cycle, I'll find out, oh, instruction one finished. And so I could say, since instruction one finished, that means this one instruction here, which was waiting for instruction one, is now ready. So I look at that and say, okay, so that's ready. And I again need to look at all my instructions and say, which ones can I put on an ALU? So I just take all the ready ones, there's only one, and assign that to an ALU. So now it's run. And it will finish. And when it finishes, instruction three was waiting for its result. And so we'll be able to start that. So up to here, although we've had two ALUs, we didn't actually have the choice to run two instructions at once. We couldn't actually take advantage of that. And this is the sort of phenomenon which caused that sort of asymptote in performance, that we couldn't get any faster because something like this was happening, where we had lots of instructions, but we couldn't use all our computational capacity on them because they depended on each other. So even though there's no stalling per se, there's a sort of stalling, but it's with this out of order processing. We just couldn't find anything to run, even though we had this list of over 10 instructions to look at, which we had an extra ALU to run. Okay. So after instruction three finishes, this is going to be a different case. So here we have one instruction, a compare, that depends on instruction three, and another instruction, an add that depends on instruction three. You'll notice here that I have this weird thing where I have a conditional jump and I have instructions after it. So the assumption here is that the instruction queue is filled after branch prediction. So we did branch prediction and we're guessing this add here is going to run. And since we're guessing it's going to run, it just goes in the instruction queue because we predicted it. We'll fix it somewhere else in the processor if we're wrong. But I'm not showing you that logic. So when instruction three finishes, we have two instructions that are ready, and we can assign both of them to an ALU. So now, finally, we take advantage of that second ALU in our processor. And then when these two instructions finish, we're going to be able to actually do the jump, which means figure out whether our branch prediction was wrong. And we're also going to be able to do the second app. So those will be ready. And during the fifth cycle, we'll again be able to send two things to the ALUs. So we'll just say we have two ready instructions. I have two ALUs. Easy. I'm going to assign both of the instructions. And I didn't mark that as ready. And after those finish, we'll have instruction the 8, which is waiting for 7, is going to be able to run, and so on. So this is basically what the instruction queue is doing. As you can see, like, this is not that hard to do by hand, but the logic that implements this is a lot more complicated than anything you did for pipelining. Like, you thought forwarding was confusing, implementing this, it's a lot worse. It's also a lot more hardware, which is why this wasn't done in the early days of processors. And to actually implement this efficiently in hardware, there's a whole bunch of extra data structures I'm not writing down to keep track of what instructions are waiting for what, where are the values I need to forward, and what branch predictions are happening that I might need to fix, and all that stuff. But the high level idea is that we have this, we wait for instructions and get them as we have them. And one way of viewing this is something we'll call a data flow. And that's by looking at how does data move from one instruction to the other based on our dependencies. And we can draw this like this. So instruction 1 value is used by instruction 2, is used by instruction 3, is used by instruction 4 and 5, and also instruction 3's value is used by instruction 6, so on. So this is just the dependencies of the instructions, which is how data flows between the instructions. And this tells us when we can start executing each of these instructions. And a key observation to make about this data flow, is that the arrow has to go forward in time. So if we want to lay out these instructions in the order they'll be executed, like we want to have each row be things executed at the same time, all the arrows need to go down. We can't have them go sideways. So the minimum we can squish this diagram is basically the shortest time we can actually execute this if we had, say, unlimited ALUs. And that means that the longest path determines our speed. So in this case, the longest path here is that we go 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, 8, 9. And that determines the speed at which we can actually do this computation. And you can see that because we have to do each of them one after each other. So we had to execute 1, then 2, then 3, then 6, then 7, then 8, then 9. And that's why we had to take 7 cycles. If we had any shortcut there, we could have saved a cycle by running instructions different times. But since we can't do that, this is the shortest we could have done it. Even if we had an extra ALU, it wouldn't help, because we couldn't make this short. And so what we're going to look at is this longest path. And we're going to just say, how long does it take to actually execute this longest path? And that's what you need to reason about to figure out how fast is something like a loop. So this is the when do instructions run side of how fast can it be. The other thing we need to think about are these execution units. So there's different kinds of execution units, and this is going to affect how fast things are. And there's two basic kinds. So when in our processor, we had an ALU, and it just worked in one cycle. So this works sometimes. So some real processors, that's what the ALU does. But processors want to do something like, say, a multiply. You can do like a 64-bit multiply in one cycle, but then you probably need to make your cycle time pretty long. So they often don't do that. So they might, for example, have a 3-stage ALU. So the ALU is pipelined and has multiple stages. So if you have this, then you're going to send in one value every cycle, one instruction, get it out 3 cycles later. So you can do multiple computations in parallel, but not only do they need to be independent, but you need to know that you're starting one the first cycle, another the second, and so on. And you're not going to get all the results at the same time. So for example, if you want to compute A times B times C times D with this ALU, that's going to take 9 cycles. So why can't we do it so in, say, 6 cycles? So 6 cycles would be we can do one multiply every cycle, and there's an extra 3 cycles to start the first one, let's say. 2 or 3. 2 cycles to start the first one. Why can't we do it in 5? 6, yeah. So what's the problem that keeps us from doing that? Why am I saying we have something pipelined, but I need 9 cycles to do 3 multiplies? Anyone? Yeah.
You have to wait for the result of C times D before.
Yeah, so the problem is that we need to get the result of C times D. So this part is 3 cycle wait. And only then can we do the B times C times D. So even though we can do one multiply a cycle, if this is the multiplies we want to do, we have to wait 3 cycles between each one. We can't wait just one. If we had independent multiplications to do, then we wouldn't have that problem. So there's another type of functional unit that you'll sometimes see, which is a bit weird, which is our unpipelined ones. So this, I don't mean ones which take one cycle, I mean ones which take a variable number of cycles. So a common example is many processors have dividers, and division is pretty complicated. And because of this, often the amount of time division takes is variable because they're doing something like repeated subtraction, or something like school book division, and it takes variable amounts of time. So the way that sort of functional unit might work is it takes an input value and also says, am I ready for the next input? And in this type of functional unit, you can only have one thing going on at a time. So if I start a division, I can't start another division until it says I'm ready. And I don't actually know how long it takes. This is also the same sort of way that a cache might work. So we send an address to the cache, and we'll get back a ready signal if it's a hit, otherwise we might not. And the processor will deal with that. So, and unlike sort of all the other functional units we've dealt with, this sort of thing, we can't actually always know what the performance is by just looking at the instructions and knowing what the functional units are. And this is one of the reasons why processors want to have this out-of-order execution, because that lets them do something good in this scenario when compilers, no matter how clever they were, couldn't really help. So any questions about functional units before we go back to looking at how we can use our knowledge of the data flow and what functional units do to actually reason about program performance? Okay. So let's take a picture of the data flow for our add, our sum operation. So if it's enrolled, it looks something like this. We have an address in the array. We need to load that. We need to increment the address. We need to load it and increment the address. This is sort of one way that might work out. And our longest path here is from that address at the top to the sum. And it has a certain minimum number of steps. And the biggest problem is that we can do at most 3 things per cycle, including just one actual useful add, the way this works. Like, that's the best we can possibly do. And that's why I was getting about one operation a cycle for my loop unrolling. because I was getting to this point where I can do one operation a cycle, you know, one actual work operation, which is that adding to the sum a cycle, and you know, that was the performance I got. And this was what the book calls the critical path. It was the longest path of our data, and it determined the latency of my operation. If I wanted to determine how long that took, I just added up the latency of each add. Just added up how long that took, including the delay to get from one end of the pipeline to the other. And on my processor, it happens I have a one cycle adder, and that's what was happening. So I had adds take one cycle, I needed to do four of them to add four things, I needed to do 900 of them to add 900 things. And this is kind of unfortunate because my processor that I was running this on has multiple ALUs that can do adds. And I only could use one of them because of this problem. And that's why I was getting the performance of just one. So we're going to see a way of getting more performance out of that. So we're going to start by looking at an example of a simpler problem. And the sort of general technique we use to do this. So this is something our book calls reassociation. So we had our multiply before, which I said we had to wait for C times D to do B times C times D. So let's say I have a pipelined five cycle latency multiplier. So how long does each of these take? And assume we can instantly forward a result back into the multiplier. Someone have answers? Who doesn't have any clue what to do? Okay, a couple people. Who thinks they have an answer to at least one of them? Okay, someone want to share over their answer?
Well, we think the one on the left is 15.
Okay, why 15? Okay, yeah, so the one on the left is 15. You need to wait five cycles to do the first multiply, five cycles to do the next one, and so on. So you have to do them all in a row, and it doesn't matter that the multiplier is pipelined, you still need to wait for it to finish all five of its pipeline stages before you start the next multiply. So you're just going to be wasting four cycles, not giving it any work. So how about anyone have an answer for the other one? Back there. So why 10?
So I feel like the A times B and C times D at the same time, five cycle latency into the final multiply step.
Yeah, so 10 is the critical path time, because we can do the two at the same time, and then we need to wait for them to finish. That takes five cycles, and then we can do the other one. So we could get that if we had the ability to start multiple multiplies at the same time. But because we have a single multiplier, we don't. If we had multiple, we'd get 10 cycles. But because we have only a single one, we get 11. Because we need to start one and then the other. Because we can't actually do them both at once. So what we're going to do is we're going to start this multiply at cycle one, this one at cycle two, and then this one at cycle seven, after the one from two, both the one and two finish. And with the original pipeline here, we had to start this at cycle one, this at cycle six, this at cycle 11. And so this is a case where exchanging the order in which we did things really helped us because it exposed more parallelism. We could do two things at once. In that case, these two multiplies, which I have marked as adds for some reason. We can do it at the same time. Yes?
So for cycle
rate, this is assuming cycle one is the first cycle. So not zero. Yes? Because we only have a single multiplier, so it's pipelined, which means it accepts values to multiply every cycle, but it only accepts one set each cycle. So we can only send one set. If we had multiple multipliers, which many processors do, then we could do this in 10 with two copies of that multiplier. Yeah. The squiggle is 7. And hopefully I didn't make an off by one error, which wouldn't be improbable. Okay, so this idea that we can reorder operations to expose more parallelism is something we can also apply to loops like that sum loop. So a better data flow to have is that we have two sums, and then we add them together at the end. So we take, in this case, the even elements and add them to sum one, and the odd elements and add them to sum two. And by doing this, we expose more parallelism. There are six operations that we can do at the same time here. In our critical path, the things we need to get done one after another is shorter. So this means that now I should be able to do 7 additions in the time it takes me to complete 4 adds, one after the other, as long as I have multiple adders, which it turns out most current desktop and laptop processors do. So this should actually give me a performance boost because I'm taking advantage of that multiple ALUs I have there and letting my instruction queues not just say, oh, I only have one instruction ready, even though I have lots of places to put instructions. Now they say, oh, I have this sum one instruction I can put on that first ALU and this sum two instruction I can put on the second one. And so hopefully we'll get a lot better performance. And so what this would look like as C code is you write something like this. And you get two independent sums and you add them up at the end. And the idea is because these sums are independent, they can be computed in parallel, and that should make our program faster. Yes? So
why are there multiple plus twos in that previous diagram? This loop looks like it only adds to I once.
So we have to somehow compute the address of A. This is assuming that the compiler compiles this to keep a pointer and increment those pointers. The most straightforward translation of this code would take A and add I plus 1 to it, which would have the same number of additions, so it doesn't affect the overall efficiency, but it would be, but it would be different than like the most straightforward translation of this code. And if I time that, I do actually get a performance improvement. So having two accumulators gets me from a little over one cycle per addition to about 0.57 cycles per addition. And then things get a little worse. So one question is, what's happening here? Yeah.
After 16, we run out of registers, so we have to start putting things in memory.
Yeah. So after 16, Yeah, so with 8, this is the code my compiler generates. They have different registers for different accumulators. Those are mapped to the same one, but different registers for most of the accumulators. When I get to 16, the compiler does something like this, where it stores some 13 on the stack and adds to the stack. And that means that we're doing extra memory accesses, which makes the code slower. So even though these are all cache hits, having to go to the load store functional unit is still going to be slower than not. And so this is why we didn't get any more performance increase. And the other part of it is that, the machine, it has multiple adders, but the number of adders it has is not that high. It's 4. Four it can do at the same time. And I was already using all of them. I was using 2 of them to compute the actual sums and 2 of them to do the address computations. So I ran out of them, get any more performance increase. Okay. So how about this 0.57 number? That's a really strange number because I am telling you we're doing 2 adds at a time. How do we get 0.57 cycles per add? What amount of time could ads take for this to happen? That's pretty strange. And probably what's going on is that you have to look at the loop overhead. And because I made my loop faster, that loop overhead became a bit more significant. And when I looked at the code my compiler generated, that I unrolled this loop 16 times, and it had 4 instructions to handle the loop. And if I think of the about one cycle, half a cycle for each of those, half or a quarter cycle for each of those, I get the 0.57. So that means that probably I could make this 0.57 down to something closer to 0.5, what we'd expect from 2 adds a cycle, 2 adds at the same time, if I unrolled my loop further. But the extra cost was just that the loop wasn't completely free of overhead. In fact, was pretty significant now that we were doing so many instructions at a time. Okay. So any questions about multiple accumulators? So I'm going to talk about another sort of orthogonal optimization for cases where we're doing lots of the same sort of operation. So we saw loop unrolling helps us when we're doing lots of the same operation by avoiding bookkeeping for each of the copies. And multiple accumulators helps us expose more parallelism between multiple similar operations. And we have this related idea of vector instruction. So modern processors don't just have an add instruction. They have an instruction that works on vectors of values. So on x86-64, there are a series of 128-bit registers that can hold 4 ints or 4 floats or 2 doubles or 8 shorts and so on. And there are instructions that treat the register as an array of values and act on all the values at once. So instead of an add instruction that just adds 2 values, we have an add instruction that adds, say, 4 or 8 pairs of values from 2 of these 128-bit registers. And to support this, the processor has extra copies of the ALU that are only accessed by these vector instructions. So instead of having an ALU that does a 32-bit add, they have 4 copies of that just right next to each other, and they feed it from these vector registers. So for example, there's an instruction PADD, which stands for packed add D word, double word, which means 32 bits in Intel's strange parlance. And if we have XMM0 contains the 128 bits representing 1, 2, 3, 4 as 32-bit integers, so that means the first 32 bits are the integer 1, the second 32 bits are the integer 2, and so on, and XMM1 contains 5, 6, 7, 8, this adds each pair going down. And the compilers can sometimes take advantage of this. So here is a very carefully written add all elements of two things together function, as compiled by, I think, Clang with the appropriate optimization options. And what this does is uses this load instruction here, which loads 128 bits from A, which is four elements, four ints, and 128 bits from B, and then uses this PADD instruction to add four pairs. And then it stores the values back in A. Stores all four of those values it just added back in A, and then does the loop. And we see that the loop advances by 16 bytes, which is 4 ints. Yes?
So the restrict keyword here means that you're just telling the compiler those two things are not aliased?
Yes, so the restrict keyword is telling the compiler that these two things are not aliased. If I didn't have the restrict keyword, this optimization is incorrect. And the compiler would need to do more work because it could be the case that like A and B point to the same array but one element off from each other. And you couldn't do it for the same reason you couldn't do something like multiple, well, for the same reason you couldn't just do straightforward reordering of loads in the loop. So sort of a graphical representation is that what we're doing is we're taking four element chunks of the two arrays, adding them together, and we get this result and then store it back. So questions on what this instruction's doing? We're certainly doing less instruction, so intuitively it's faster, saying the processor can implement that instruction about as fast as an add, which it can. And so you saw that sometimes compilers will actually do this optimization. And in fact, when I talked about cache blocking, you remember I said I made the loop a lot better? And I showed you this graph, but no one remarked on why are these big spikes. Well, those big spikes are because that we do better at multiples of 8. Because I was using vectors of 8 values and this kind of instruction. And I wasn't doing it. The compiler did it for me when I wrote my code appropriately and passed the right compiler options to make this happen. So that's sort of the assembly level. And at a hardware level, as I said, basically what happens is that we have this vector ALU, which is just a whole bunch of copies of the ALU, multiple what are often called lanes. So this is the lot of space in the hardware, and that seems pretty wasteful. Why, to support these instructions, do we make our ALUs four times bigger or worse? Why would we do that? And the reason why this makes sense for processor manufacturers to do has to do with everything else that was in our picture of a modern processor. So if you remember this picture here, there's a whole lot of other stuff in the processor. There's lots of this instruction queue, this fetch and decode stuff. There's a lot of extra stuff that is not actually related to executing the instruction. And so all this logic that's not dedicated to computation, seems like, why am I wasting all my processor space, all my transistors on that? I want to actually do more computation. And this is a good way of doing that that involves adding very little extra control logic. So it's very efficient, And it's going to give you more performance benefit than if I just added extra normal ALUs, but still had to add the extra logic to the instruction queue to actually figure out how to use them. And because of this, pretty much all modern processors, not just x86, have added these vector instructions and these vector ALUs in order to get more processing power on one chip. So those are vector instructions as an IDO. And I showed you that compilers sometimes use vector instructions. So they sometimes can figure out, oh, I can do these two things at once. And they've gotten much, much, much better than they used to be. So vector instructions are surprisingly old, date back to like the 80s. There were machines which were based on having these types of instructions in the 80s. And one of the promises that for a long time was really, really not fulfilled was having compilers that could actually take advantage of this. We've gotten much better at this in the past decade, but it's still very variable. This is something which is not trivial for compilers to do, and it's not trivial in ways which aren't obvious to you. So for example, aliasing is really bad for doing this. The compiler needs to make sure there's not aliasing because it's reordering the adds. It's doing two adds that might depend on each other now in parallel. So it needs to prove there's no aliasing to do this. You can have trouble with conditionals. Adding a conditional to your loop means now I don't know if there are always four adds in parallel. And the compiler, if it doesn't know how to deal with that, might just generate code without the vector instructions, and that might be like four times slower. And if there's any sort of operation which doesn't happen to have a vector instruction, or the compiler can't figure out what combination of vector instructions do it, it's probably going to have to generate code which uses the normal instructions that will do one element of the vector at a time. So with our vectors of 4 ints, basically 4 times slower than if you had a vector instruction for it. And still even slower if you could like do it with 2 vector instructions in some way. Like if you could do something with an add and a shift, you know, rather than a divide, that would be a lot better. But the compiler, if it doesn't know that, not going to be able to take advantage of vector instructions at all, probably. And to actually do the places where they figure it out, compilers rely on lots of sort of heuristics, and this is surprisingly fragile. So for example, this above code here, GCC 7.2 and Clang 5 generate vector instructions for. The bottom, they don't. I do not expect you to be able to figure out when they will or will not. I certainly can't. But this is the sort of variability that happens with compilers. They just have some cases, they have the logic to do it, some they don't. They're getting better. Probably this will eventually, you know, be more consistent. But these are the sorts of surprises you run into. And it's not that you can't generate vector instructions for the second one. There's still a relatively straightforward thing that's a big benefit to do. But it's just that the compilers don't figure it out in this case. And you know, like there's even like more subtle things, like Clang 5 apparently doesn't like it if you switch all the ints to longs in the indices only. Don't know why, you know? But this is the sort of surprises we've gotten from compilers that try to do vectorization. So certainly, you should look at, does my compiler do this for me? Can I make it easier for my compiler to do? But often, people still find themselves wanting to generate code that uses these vector instructions more manually because the compilers have trouble figuring it out. And you yourself can organize your code in a way where you know what things you want to happen in parallel. And one thing we could do is we could have you write this sort of assembly by hand. We could have you write these vector instructions, which we'll call SIMD. I will explain that term in a bit. By hand. So we call it SIMD because it's single instruction, multiple data. I should have had a slide on that. Single instruction, multiple data. This is the same thing as vector instructions. But we have this second option, which is popularized by Intel and available in many compilers, which are what Intel calls intrinsic functions. So these are C functions that will compile down to particular instructions. So this way you can say, I want to use that PID instruction for this. I know that's the right thing to do, and you can tell the compiler exactly where you want to do that, but have the compiler deal with all the loop indexing and all that stuff that it's actually pretty good at. And so this is typically, but not always, how people will write vectorized code, and there's sort of equivalent things you might be able to find for other architectures besides x86. We'll be looking at x86 and the vector instructions that use the XMM registers. So, for example, if I was writing that existing code with vector instructions, it would look something like this, which is awfully confusing. So we'll go over this piece by piece. So first of all, there's a whole bunch of weird types in here. Also, everything starts with underscores and M's. So everything starts with underscores. Intel made some bad choices. The type names, types start with two underscores. Intel made some really bad choices. So first we have this strange underscore underscore M128i type. And this is 128 bits of integers is what this means. So this is a data type that holds 128 bits, and the I indicates it probably represents integers. So this data type is a variable that can be stored in one of those 128-bit XMM registers. So then we have these special functions, which all begin with, in this case, underscore mm underscore. So each of these functions corresponds basically to a single instruction. So this function, load u si128, corresponds to a move from memory to a register instruction. That's what it's going to compile into. And it moves from, you know, it moves a 128-bit value from memory, which is what the SI128 is in the name for, and moves it to a register, which hopefully is the register where A values is stored. So this generates the move DQU instruction we saw in the compiler-generated code. Yes?
What if you run out of these big registers? Stack.
So yeah, the question is, what happens if you run out of big registers? Just like if with normal ints, it's going to send it to the stack, yes. So the compiler will manage the registers that are used in this case. That's one of the things it will do. And we'll figure out how to move values to and from registers in order to do the instructions you tell it to do. Typically, if you do it right, everything will stay in registers. Sometimes things might go to the stack. You also have a store function here. So this takes a value sums and sends it to memory somewhere. We have these weird casts of the pointers to the array to this a pointer to a 128-bit value type. That's just to represent I want to store a block of 128 bits starting at that part of the array. So if we're casting AI, it's an array of ints, so that's going to be four elements of the array we're going to load or store into. So then we have this function that represents the add instruction. So I showed you PID earlier was add 32-bit integers. This is the name that Intel chose for the function that corresponds to that instruction. So the EPI32 is their notation for four 32-bit integers. So this adds four 32-bit integers, the first one from A values with the first one from B values, then the second one from A values with the second one from B values, and so on, and returns its result as another 128-bit collection of four integers. So any questions about anything in this code? So I understand that Intel has made some very bad choices as far as how they name things. which I think is one of the biggest annoyances when people see this. I'm reusing Intel because we have x86 processors in the lab, not going to use ARM. And I wouldn't count on ARM's naming choices for similar things actually being any better. So any questions beyond why did they choose EPI 32 instead of something more sensible? Okay. And so I've shown you this with adding a bunch of 32-bit values together from two arrays. There are different versions of these instructions for different sized values. So for example, here's the same code where instead of acting on ints, I act on longs. And I just changed my array indexing and changed EPI 32 to EPI 64. And this worked because there's an instruction that adds 64-bit integers in addition to one that adds 32. If there wasn't, there wouldn't be that function. And you'd get a compiler, or, hey, that function doesn't exist. And there aren't functions for all possible, aren't instructions for all possible sizes. So, if there isn't one, you'll have to do it some other way. Okay, so this is sort of a toy example because it's pretty obvious how this add four pairs of integers instruction actually corresponds to what we want to do. A less obvious case is when we had, say, our square function that I did that hash blocking on. So how do we actually make that take advantage of these vector instructions? How do we do multiple things at once with that? And the way we're going to do that is we're first going to start by unrolling it. This is generally probably where you should start looking when you want to take advantage of vector instructions. And the reason why is you want to do pairs of, in this case, four things, because we have vectors that will hold four values. So you want to do pairs of four things, and unrolling is one way of getting four things all in one step. And if you didn't have the right four things, you might reorder the loops to find them. This is our general pattern to look for pairs of four things. And we see we have four very similar operations. And that's great, because we can probably find a way to do each of the parts of this with vector instructions. So we have four adds. We want to do that with one instruction, because we have an instruction that adds four things at once. We have four multiplies. And it turns out we have an instruction that multiplies four values at once. So we're going to want to take advantage of that. And so this is the blueprint for how we're going to use vector instructions to do this. So we need some operations I haven't shown you. So I'll just tell you what they are. So one is that there's this intrinsic function for take a value, a 32-bit value, and load it four times into a 128-bit value. So make four copies of it in the 128-bit value. And this sort of scenario is precisely why that exists, because they wanted to support it. And there's also multiply 32-bit values, give me the lowest 32 bits of the results of the multiplication. And so to vectorize this, I'm going to just look part piece by piece at how we turn each piece into some vector operation. So first, we need to load the values from B. These are all adjacent in memory. So I can load 128 bits at once, and that's going to represent my Bs. And when I'm done, I can store the modified 128 bits. And I can also, for the A, K times N plus J, those are all next to each other. So I can load 128 bits from A, all next to each other, into a vector, and work on that. And for this part, so the A single element AIK, that's what that set one thing is useful for. So I want to have four copies of it, because I want to do four things with it, four different things with it. And then I use the multiply low, and things happen to be lined up. K, J plus 0 is my lined up with the first copy, j plus 1 is lined up with the second copy, and so on. So we're doing all these multiplies that I wanted to do. So then we need to do this addition, and that I loaded bij, I take the multiplication results and add it to that. And this is exactly 4 parallel additions of each of those values, and then I store it back. So that means that the inside of this loop becomes something like this. Right. This is big and ugly, but that's the result of applying those steps. That's what you get, and that does 4 additions and 4 multiplies with 1 instruction. So it's going to be a lot faster, and that's the sort of thing my compiler, in this case, could figure out how to do. Yes?
Where do you increment j?
Where do I increment j? In what sense? So you mean why is there no j plus equals? So this is just the body of this loop, first of all. So that's why there's no j plus equals 4. That makes sense? So the other question is why don't I have to add anything to j in the middle, say here? And that's because when I load 128 bits starting with j plus 0, I'm going to get j plus 1, because that's the next thing in memory, and j plus 2 and j plus 3. And the same is true for the j with a. So these load instructions, I'm not loading that particular element, I'm loading that element and whatever's after it. Because I'm loading 128 bits from an array of 32-bit things. Any questions on this? Fusion? So this is the basic idea. We're going to have a lab on using these next week, which will hopefully be a nice, gentle introduction. And then we want you to do it for the smooth homework. It might technically be possible to do the smooth homework without using this, but I don't think so. I've deliberately chosen compiler settings where the compiler will never vectorize it for you, mostly because, even though that's more realistic, I don't want you to play, how do I like change my longs to ints so the compiler figures out how to do it. That is not actually useful learning. And sometimes the compiler won't do it, and that's the useful case where you'd want to figure this out, or sometimes the compiler will do it, will vectorize things, but not in the best way. And that's why it's really useful to know how to do this by hand. So before I finish up, I've shown you sort of one way of writing vector operations explicitly. There are other ones out there that we're just not going to use because it's not the most convenient thing for our processor. So GCC, our book mentions briefly, has vector extensions that look more like normal C code. So they have the disadvantage of you don't always know whether that thing turns into one instruction, but the advantage that they might, you know, be able to be used on multiple platforms. GPUs. The way why GPUs are fast is that they're actually just machines which are basically all vector instructions. And usually with not 128-bit wide vectors, but with like 1,000-bit wide vectors. And they have a very different way of programming, something which looks more like multi-threaded code. And the compilation process is much more complicated, and there's also some extra hardware support to make that work. But these are other things. It's the same idea, but the programming model might be very, very different. But what you would need to think about in order to figure out, can I use these fast instructions, is basically the same stuff. So that's what I have for today. Thank you. Luck on the labs.